Good morning and welcome to the Niagara-Friedberg conference call. I'm David Rosberg, and with me this morning is Albert Friedberg. Good morning, Al. How are you doing this morning?
Good, David. Good. Thank you.
Today is April the 30th. I'm saying this in deference to Eddie Rott, our able administrator who looks after these calls in addition to his many other duties. If there are any questions that you have during the call, you can email them to him, erott@niagaracapital.ca. After we're done, the calls will be posted on the Friedberg and the Niagara website in the form of podcasts. You can listen to them on your exercise machine if you like. Just to finish off with this little bit of business before we start, we try and keep the calls limited to 45 minutes, and the way we do it is Al will offer some introductory comments about the performance of the fund, and then I'm going to ask him some questions that have been posed by investors already, and as I say, if you have any additional questions, please send them to Eddie. Okay, without further ado, let's get going. Al, you had a nice first quarter, up almost 7%, and in the last 2 weeks of April, things have turned absolutely horrendous for you. As of last night's close, we're down 11.5% during the month. What's happened?
Okay, David. No, you're right. It's been a very, very disappointing, very unpleasant experience the last couple of weeks. It actually, all of it happened practically the last 2 weeks, and it has forced us to. Let me first tell you where it came. About 5% of that 11.5%, 5.1% actually in our numbers, came from a correction in the main two markets that we're long, which is the housing market, the airline market, and a little bit of the in the Nikkei. I was about 5% of that 11.5. The balance of the loss of 6.4% came in all our what's called our protective positions, our hedges, and that includes things like bonds, gold, short positions, especially short positions in the market. So what it forced us to do was to resume once again the process of trimming, which we had thought would come to an end sometime in the first quarter. We had reduced our positions so that our leverage was what we thought was very comfortable, up to 4.5 times. And what we did now, we were forced to do now in the last 2 weeks of April, is to cut it back further, and now we're down to 3.5 times leverage. Of course, we have maintained all our core positions, and in fact, some of them we have increased a little bit during this, taking the opportunity of the decline. But this has forced us to do two things. Number one, to close out a lot of the hedges. And number two, to rethink what need is there at the moment for protection. And this is a difficult question because we've been grappling with this question for the past 4 years. And the reason we've been grappling for it is because we all know that there's been a lot of artificial measures being taken by governments around the world to lift economic activity. There's been tremendous reliance on monetary policy. And we know that these artificial measures, they don't have any fundamentals, they are very cosmetic, they create a tremendous amount of misallocation of resources by lowering rates to where they did. We know that this ends in trouble. We've seen it happen in the last round, which was the year 2000, from 2003 to 2006, and then it ended in tears in 2008. We've seen it happen earlier. We've seen it happen in Asia in the late 90s, and we've seen it happen in the 70s too. The question is one of timing. How long will it take for this to happen? Well, what we misjudge for the past 4 years, and I must say that's a huge error, we misjudge the relentlessness, the persistence, the willingness to experiment, to continue to experiment with cheap money that these central banks have had. And it's one reinforcing the other. It's first the United States did it, did what's called QE in order to rescue the market and rescue the economy from its liquidity crisis. And then it became, then the reasons became, of course, less, became vaguer why they did it. And then other countries began to pick up, and so did Japan. And then, of course, the latest one is Europe. And the even latest one appears to be China. So we have this reinforcing action, one central bank looking at another one and saying, gee, we can do the same thing. We can do the same thing. So we misjudged this. We actually thought that this would have to come to an end, but it doesn't come to an end. And we think now that the only way it will come to an end is when the effects, the real consequences of these actions are seen. Now, it's very, very difficult to have defaults, massive defaults, bankruptcies of any sort when you have money that's this easy. So the only thing that can happen and that will be sort of the consequences of this action, the only thing that is actually inevitable, but we may have to wait a little longer, we don't know how long, is that this will cause inflation. And when it does, and when we start getting inflation rates that move up from the present 2 to 3 or 4, and this is going to happen, when it does, I think this is when central banks will be forced finally to react. Anybody who listened to yesterday's Fed report or who read it, or anybody who's read any of the central bank reports, sees continuously this idea that they're data dependent, that the economy is not going fast enough. Remember, the initial reason for QE was really to rescue the economy from illiquidity. This is no longer the case. Now the case is we're not growing fast enough. 2% is not fast enough. We need to grow faster. and we will continue to do what needs to be done, which is continue to press on the accelerator. So having sort of understood this now, I mean, it's fairly simple, pretty elementary. And if you ask anybody in the street, they will tell you this. But, you know, for us, it was just unseemly, impossible that this thing can come from intelligent people. Having seen this and their determination to do this, we have come to the conclusion, and the market has made us come to that conclusion, forcing us to actually cover and get rid of any or almost most of the hedges that we have had, and saying there is no need for it now. We will have to wait until we get to see the consequences, and those will be when we get to see higher rates of inflation. So the last few weeks have been very painful, but it's something that we have to take, it's something that we had to take, and that is to finally merge this idea that is so obvious to everyone, and it was not obvious to us, and that is close out the hedges, close out the protection. And now, as it stands now, we have the highest long equity position that we've had in 4 years. We now are practically 85% long in our equity positions, net long. And that is the highest position since in the last 4 years. So we are very excited about these core positions. We continue to, as I said before, and as I've been repeating for a long time, these are very, very exciting positions. All of them have very strong possibilities to do exceedingly well in the next few months and years. And we hope that will happen. It's just now a question of waiting. So, you know, we can discuss these, but that's really what's happened in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, okay, so let's discuss this. But to summarize, if I may, correct me if I'm wrong, what you're saying is that for the past several years, you've maintained an anxiety that as a consequence of Fed actions, some seismic type event would occur that would destroy wealth that was accumulated by positions that were strictly on the long side. You kept on guarding yourself in the form of hedges. Initially, 2 years ago, those hedges were largely in short in emerging markets. More recently, they've been being long bunds, having a more modest short long position in gold, and having some credit default swaps on European credits. And as happened in India, consistently, this market moved against you. The catastrophic event that you feared didn't occur, and finally you've come to acknowledge that it's not likely to occur unless you see its manifestation in the form of increases in inflation. But is that an accurate summary?
That's absolutely accurate. That's exactly the case. By the way, also we've had short position U.S. stocks along the lines. Here and there we've added to that position, but that's correct. That was the way we did it.
It's your view then that at the present time, at least, to seek protection against this type of an event is to seek a protection against the kind of against a kind of a chimera. It's crept into the imagination, but at the present time, at least because inflation is so muted, it's not something to be feared in reality. And therefore, the fund's risk is really now in concentration risk. It's the risk of the long positions that you have so much conviction over. Is that the way you see it?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And by the way, that's what we did, for example, in the which I discussed in one of the quarterly reports with the asset allocation fund, where we were cognizant of the risk, realized that there was a risk, were concerned about it, and therefore it didn't have a very aggressive position in investment assets. But having said that, we did not lose any money because we actually made money because we did not do this quote unquote foolish thing of betting on an event, on a cataclysmic event, as you were mentioning. So yes, we've given it up. We now have a different risk, which is, you said it very well, which now is a concentration risk. We believe that we are concentrated now in, at least in the equity end, we concentrate in three main areas. We also concentrated you might call it concentration. We are short oil, crude oil still. Those are really our main positions, and therefore, the volatility may be higher than the market volatility, and we've seen this happen the last 2 weeks where some of our good core positions had a very strong reaction, and that has an effect on our portfolio, but we think that it would be more than compensated by the upside potential.
So let's discuss some of these then in a more granular way. Before I do, I just want to point out that historically, I think that many people have come to think of you as being a perma-bear, and that success will only come to you when catastrophe occurs. But in fact, most of over the history of FMG, as I've known it, and I've known it for many years since the 70s, is, you know, most of the returns have come not because of bearish conditions, not because of catastrophes, but because of these very concentrated bets that you made, beginning in the 70s with a long position in short, and long positions in gold, and long positions in silver. So this is not something that's fallen outside of your bailiwick. I think that there are many investors who may be listening who think that it's only by being short that we can do well. So this is, in a way, at least from my own perspective, a kind of return to the free bird culture, not a drifting away from it.
Yeah, that's true. That's correct.
Okay, so let's look at some of these positions in a more granular way, beginning with the largest one, which is housing. I think the best way to address this is in the form of a question that's been sent by an investor, and I'll just read it. If you've maintained a steadfast and very positive view with regards to the U.S. home building sector, in fact, this position represents far and away the largest equity position in the fund, and as much as 70% of the net asset value. Stocks have been slow to recognize its potential. Dare say that improvement will be slow at a great cost to margins. Also, they claim that rising interest rates are sure to slow down sales. Are you still bullish? And how do you see it?
we're very, very bullish and getting increasingly more bullish as we start seeing some of the statistics that are coming out. For example, we've had very, very strong sales numbers of single-family houses. We've had an increase to, the last figure that I saw was 510,000 units at an annual rate. Now, that was an increase of 26 or 27% over the year before, yet starts. Home builders beginning the construction of homes has only been increased by something like 2 or 3% during that period. Right. In fact, the spread between the amount of houses being sold, new houses being sold, and the amount of starts is telling me that, and that's the widest that we've had in 20 years since 1995. It's telling me that they are being caught unaware, almost, that this market is now beginning to consume, to buy. Homes at a very fast clip, and they're caught, and I think that they will need to catch up, and the catch up will be extremely profitable for them. Albeit there are problems with acquiring land and things of that sort, but the point is that margins are going to be continue to be good, relatively good. Volumes are going to increase significantly. Today, mortgage application numbers came out, and they're up 20% over last year. That's a huge number. 20% is the first time that we have such an increase. So we know that the street is buying. And I think the last guys to know practically are the home builders. And so it will maybe take maybe another few weeks or maybe another month or two, but I think that very soon we'll find out that if they have to ramp up production, and they have to satisfy a consumer. And we have all seen the prices have gone up, and prices continue to go up around 8% a year. And the reason prices have gone up is because there's practically no inventory. There is less than 5 months' worth of inventory at present rates of purchases. So the consumer has nowhere to go, and the home builders have to satisfy that demand. And the demand is very powerful. And it's going to be, I think that we're looking at a real boom in housing starts and profitability over the next, in home builders profitability over the next year.
Your other high conviction trades are long Nikkei, long airlines, and you have a bearish view on oil, which in some way is related to airlines. Have you lightened up those positions in the last 2 weeks in the wake of what's happened?
No. We have not lightened up, and we actually think that they're great stories. All of them are great stories. I mean, the Japanese story is a simple story. It's been a 20-year bear market, or more than 20-year bear market that finally has broken out. What you say in technical parlance has broken out of the downtrend. It's moving up strongly, and it's backed by heavy buying by the Bank of Japan of bonds. And by the way, the buying that the Bank of Japan is doing is a big story. It's a very big story because that may indicate, that may tell us what the next big surprise in the market will be. The Bank of Japan, right now, so the end of 2015, will own about 25% of all the bonds. Right. Let's remember that Japan has the highest gross debt to GDP ratio in the Western world. It's about 260%, although it's much less if you look at it from a net point of view. But at any rate, the Bank of Japan will own 25%, and they're buying practically an entire deficit today. By the end of 2016, at this pace, they will own 40% of the debt. And by the end of 2020, they will own two-thirds of it. All right, so assuming that they go on till 2020, but if they even go on for the next 2 years, they will own more than 50%. The big story here is a story that of defeasance. The government, the bank...
Sorry, could you repeat that, please?
Defeasance, meaning cancellation. The Bank of Japan is really another arm of the government of Japan. And so, on one hand, the government owes the money. On the other hand, the government owns the debt, right? It's the right hand and the left hand. The right hand owes the money, and the left hand has lent it the money. So there's no need really to raise taxes, which has been the big fear over the market has been the raise of taxes. As you know, the previous government before they raised consumer taxes and they raised it to, they were going to raise it to up to 10%. Now in the next few months, it first went up to 8, and now went to 10. 8 sort of offset that increase by doing spending in other areas. But the point is that these increases in sales taxes are very detrimental to the economy. They can cause a recession very easily. And they've done that in the past, in the late 90s. And so the market has been having this overhang, this fear, that to service this debt, the government will have to raise the sales taxes to such levels that it would implode, the economy would implode. Well, the big story is that if the government itself owns the debt, there is no need, there's actually no need for the government, for the fiscal authorities, to raise taxes. They can simply cancel the debt. And I think that will happen formally in the next few years, where the Bank of Japan will tell the central, will tell the Treasury, we own half of the debt, and maybe we will own almost all the debt, and we'll just tear up the piece of paper, and you don't owe us anything. And so there's no need for tax increases. So I believe that the market in Japan is, in a way, is sensing that there is no more danger of an increase in taxes. And that's big. That's a big thing. Not only that's big, but the central bank is buying bonds, they're buying the bonds from the pension funds, and they're giving them the money to buy equities, because that's where they have to go. They have nowhere else to go. And so it's almost an open and shut case that the equity market in Japan has to go higher. So we think that's a great story. It's a story that's not been completely understood yet. There's much more to go, and we're going to see much higher prices there.
Before we go to oil, airlines, and Blackstone, which I didn't mention, let me just ask you if this mechanism were not also applicable to quantitative easing in the U.S. and by currently what's happening to the ECB. Can they also not cancel?
It is. That's my point. My point is that we have moved in an era of heightened chutzpah, in a way, you might call it that way, where monetary fiscal authorities will do anything, practically anything that was, it's inconceivable what they're doing today. It was never in anybody's mind 20 or 30 years ago, let alone maybe even 10 years ago. Nobody thought this could be done. And so this has been done in steps, in stages. First QE in order to save the country from Brown and Banks, so from an illiquidity crisis. Then QE in order to stimulate the economy. Then QE because you just can't stop QE, because if you stop QE, who knows what will happen. And then finally QE as a way of getting rid of the debt, getting rid of the many years of overspending that the governments have done and have created this enormous debt. They don't know how to get out of it. Well, the easiest way to get out of it is for the central bank to buy it. And for now, they have not been punished for that. Whatever they have done for now works very well. Right? And so why not? Why tax the people when you can buy back the debt?
And you can defease the debt. Is that the word?
Defeasance. Exactly. Defeasance. Correct. Yes. That's a technical term used also in bonds where you just cancel the debt.
Okay, let's turn now to airlines. I think that's your second largest division, is it not?
That's another great story, because that's an industry that, as far as I remember, almost it's been 30 or 40 years of losses. Since the deregulation, they've been losing money. And we know that 22 years, I think, was the number that I recall now, of steady losses except for 1 year of gains. And the reason is they had the overcapacity. They were able to buy planes and on cheap terms, and because there was overcapacity, anybody that wanted to go into the airline business went in. the personnel costs skyrocketed, fuel costs covered skyrocketed, and financing costs brought them down to their knees. And so they went through many different phases of bankruptcies and reorganizations, one after the other. And finally, as you keep doing that, if you keep doing that, every time you do that, you prune and you become trimmer and leaner. Every time you do that, that's what happens. And so finally, by the early 2000s, they became much leaner and they started showing profits. 2013, even with price of oil being where it was, actually, price of oil was 80 cents a gallon in 2000. It was $3 a gallon, I think, in 2013, and they still were making money. But not a tremendous return of capital, but they were making money. And then they made more money after that. They consolidated further into four or five major airlines in the U.S. And so now they're consolidated, and now they have a much leaner workforce, and now they have much better control over capacity. And of course, on top of all this, the price of oil has come down. So even with the price of oil coming down, by the way, $1.80, let's say, a gallon for American Airlines in the first quarter, it's still a dollar a gallon higher than it was in 2000, but it is a lot cheaper than the highs, and they're making money from that. It's an industry that is just begun to emerge. And this is one of the things that we got to look at, is industries that have begun to emerge from long periods of either dormancy or long periods of losses. The inevitable result after big losses is gains. And I think that's one of those industries that will gain from that.
The airline position originated with this view of that consolidation would grant some pricing power and increase margins, but right. It was abetted by the fortuitous, if you were along the airlines, drop in oil.
Correct.
You're also bearish on oil. In fact, I think we'd have to characterize oil as a conviction or a short bet on oil as a conviction trade of very long standing. Where do you stand on it, and how correlated is it to the long airline position?
Let me first go back with the last question. How correlated is it? It seems to be somewhat correlated. There are days when oil is strong. For example, yesterday was an example where oil was strong and airline stocks took a pounding. And sometime midday, they were down almost 5%. They recovered, and they were only down at the end, maybe 2-2.5%, which was a lot more than the market. But they were hit by some selling. I don't believe that the correlation is, I think, as I say, the market realizes that, there is more than just oil, in this equation, the market will continue to favor airlines. And as they take their cash flow and they buy back shares, which is what they're going to do, and not use it for more airlines, hopefully anyway, the market will take cognizance of that. Now, but let me go back to the bigger picture is now actually about the price of oil. And there's a misconception in the market that, you know, anything that goes down goes back up right away. And this is what happened in 2009. The price of oil went down. At that time, it went down because of world depression. And then it rebounded quickly when the economies turned around, and especially when China turned around, because China was an enormous buyer of crude oil. It's not the same thing happening today. It's not at all the same thing. It's a major difference, because since 2009, we've had the emergence of fracking in the United States, which has added 4 million or 4.5 million barrels a day, and has changed the picture, totally changed the picture, the world, the global picture of oil. And so not only we have added to production, but we also have had substitution in some areas. And we are having competition from solar. We're having competition, even though a little indirectly, having competition with natural gas that went down a tremendous amount. So the picture is changing, and it's changing against oil in a very significant way. And what's more interesting, the cost structure in the oil industry, the fracking industry, which in the beginning there were a lot of doubters a lot of people who thought that it wouldn't work, that these wells only last, they exhaust themselves after like 3 months or 4 months, and the cost is too high, and so on and so forth. All of these doubts have been put away. All these doubts have now been answered. We've seen that ever since the big collapse in November, December, oil production in the United States continues at approximately the same level, despite the fact that the drill rigs, the number of drill rigs in the place there, are down more than 50%. So they're using them much more efficiently. A very interesting point that we've seen in natural gas. The U.S. produces a third more natural gas today with 280 rigs. This is a piece of statistics they saw recently. The U.S. produces one third more natural gas today with 280 rigs than in 2009 with 1,200 rigs. That's a huge difference. It means that they've become much more efficient and much more productive. And the same thing is happening in the oil area. In fact, we're finding new areas for fracking, and some of them are enormous. For example, there's a new area, Pioneer Natural Resources announced that they found a tremendous amount of reserves in the Permian Basin of West Texas. Listen to this number. It can produce 5 to 6 million barrels a day within 4 years, which is equal to the largest well in Saudi Arabia, the Ghawar field. So the economics have changed. The oil is overhanging the market. Where the market go up to $65 or so in the U.S., I think you have a flood of more oil coming out. Those who expect fracking to disappear are wrong. Fracking will not disappear. Fracking, I think, will be in existence and will continue, even at $30 a barrel. It's just a question of how fast they can adjust to their cost. So fracking has changed the industry without any doubt. It has changed the market, and we think that it has put a cap in the market. By the way, short of I've always couched it in those terms, short of a war in the Middle East where wells are destroyed or something of that sort. Fracking has changed the business and has changed the price of oil. And we think that we have, as I said before, I've said it many times, a $60-$65 cap, and we have maybe a downside of $20 or $25. And in the meantime, you can sell oil and remain short. And those who are long should realize that it costs them almost 80 cents to $1.20 a month to hold the position, because there's a lot of oil around and you have to pay for the storage.
And you're short the back month, taking advantage.
You're short the back month, right? Exactly. You take advantage of what's called the contango.
Okay.
It's a profitable position, and you just have to be patient.
Let's give a brief moment to Blackstone. I know that Blackstone's not quite as large a position as the as you have in airlines and in housing,
no.
but you have a position in Blackstone.
Yeah, it's about 6 to 7% of the portfolio. You know, Blackstone is a very, very intelligent player. You know, I wish we had been Blackstone. Then we could have been Blackstone had we had 100% of our portfolio in Blackstone. But Blackstone is a very savvy operator in real estate markets, in energy markets, in almost anything. They have great manpower, great team, human resources are tremendous. They have great access to credit, great access to investors, pools of money. They've raised enormous amounts of money, pools of $5, $10, $14 billion for investment opportunities. They make a very good return on these. They make fees, very good fees, and they are trading at a very. I think they're under. They're certainly underpriced in relation to any to other investment banks, money managers, etc. I believe that the stock is at least 30 or 40% underpriced.
And low yields are very very useful to them.
Very
benign. It's a very benign environment for them.
Exactly, exactly. They are the ideal beneficiaries of cheap money. And this is something that we said when we first bought them around $28, $27, $28, when we first bought the shares, we said, who is the biggest beneficiary of cheap money? And, you know, inevitably it was Blackstone.
Yeah, I'm sure there are a lot of investors who are thinking about the position that you had in Bunds and the position that you had in gold, but Bunds in particular. When you say that you trimmed back the protection that you took in fear of disaster, I'm assuming that the Bunds and the gold were both shoots that were trimmed. Is that right? And if so, could you tell us where you stand now with the Bunds in particular, but also with the gold?
Correct. Both of those, we had large positions. The Bunds actually ended up being one of our best, maybe the best single investment over the last 3 years, or two, 3 years, where we rode it from yields of, I can't remember anymore, I may be wrong, but I think it may have been a 1.5% yield on those bonds to 8 basis point yield a week ago. So, we used it not just as an instrument of a carry, which was a very profitable carry too for a long time, but we used it as a protection against anything untoward happening in the European zone. In recent days, with two things happening, number one, let me say this, that the yield spread between bonds and U.S. Treasuries widened significantly and beyond any historical, beyond historical levels, way beyond historical levels. And many investors were actually selling bonds and buying treasuries already 6 months ago or longer, trying to capture that spread. But of course, it was a different story. And then, you know, the bond story is a simple story. Number one, the government is not running a budget deficit, so they're not manufacturing any more bonds. There's a static amount of bonds practically. Number two, the inflation rates in the eurozone as a whole, and remember they are priced in euros, so inflation rate in the eurozone is very low, maybe zero, so in the real return in bonds was still there. You can't say the same thing about U.S. Treasuries. There was no real return in U.S. Treasuries. We had negative rates in U.S. Treasuries. But at any rate, there was a very wide spread. That spread came to its widest early March. From that point on, it seemed almost obvious that any pullback in the U.S. Treasury would affect bonds. It would inevitably affect bonds just because of these arbitrage type of trades. And we were not fast enough. We gave it a little bit of time. We weren't fast enough to see that because, you know, we've held this position for so long because we felt it was good protection if anything were to happen, for example, in Greece. So we waited a little bit, and then we liquidated half the position. Pretty close to, I would say, if you look at it over the period of time, it's pretty close to the highs. So we now are we still own half a position. We think that at around 35 basis points or so, bonds represent, again, some value, especially as you know, the ECB is continuing to buy them. So not only is the federal government in Germany not issuing more bonds, but the ECB is buying them. There's very little outstanding. There's very little to be had. So I don't think that the decline will be very steep. I think that it may be over by next week. But we are prepared for a move to around 35, 38 basis points.
So you're standing,
we're liquidated a half of that position.
So you're standing across the table from Bill Gross, who calls it the short of the century, and Jeff Grinroth, who's prepared to leverage a short trade 20 to 1. What did he say? 100 to 1, I think.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I am. I'm not sure I'm happy about that, but I am. I do think that. That there's substantial differences between that and treasuries, and I think that the spread can actually go to 400 points between 10-year treasuries and bonds. It can happen. The U.S. is running a much higher rate of inflation. The economy is a lot stronger. The unemployment rate is a lot. The employment pool, let's put it this way, unemployment rate has gone down so much that we are very close to what you might call full employment. That's not the case in the Eurozone. I think that there's good grounds to think, and the advantage of the boots is that it gives you some protection. Should anything happen anywhere in the world, actually, because it's the number one credit instrument in the world, the best credit rating in the world, is likely to be a place where people will want to buy and people want to own.
So are you comfortable with half the position that you once had, or are you looking to liquidate that half, or are you looking to reassume the half that you sacrificed?
No, I don't think unless we get down to down to levels of about 40 basis points, maybe it's at 40 basis point yields, we might want to get back and buy back some of that. Not quite the same level position. It depends on what's happening in the risk area, what is happening with Greece, what is happening with Europe in general.
Sorry to cut you off like that. I'm getting sensitive to the time. Before we come to what seems to me to be a good summary question, talk a little bit about gold.
Yeah. So gold is another one of those positions that we think that offers some protection in case of a problem. The market is extremely negative. Sentiment is extremely negative on gold. Yet the prices have more or less have been hovering around $1,200 an ounce, and it's been more than a year. So it seems the market has found its level, and now not only will defaults be something at which gold can profit from, or at least gold will react positively to, but I believe that as we start getting higher rates of inflation, gold will also do well. The question is, should we own 15%, should we have a 15% exposure to gold, which is what we have, or should we have no exposure and then wait until it breaks out? I think there's been a big discussion in our firm, those who believe that we shouldn't have any, and should wait until it begins, until we see things happening. They've been right for most of the time anyway, they've been right till now, and those who think that no, we should have some exposure to it because these things can happen very quickly and the market will move $30 or $40 or $50 and then you're chasing the market higher and you have a higher rate of risk. So I believe somewhere around 15% exposure is about right, and I also don't think that the market is going much lower than here. I think 1200 is a very solid level. Say 1180, 1220 is a very solid range, and the next important move in the gold will be higher.
By the way, when you were speaking earlier about inflation growth as being the signal for an end to this kind of inorganically benign environment, if I can characterize it in that way, are you looking at the open monetary aggregate that we used to look at in the 70s as a precursor to that?
Yes. Yeah, that's what we do. We actually watch it every week, and I still remember in the 70s we were watching every week. That was the big. The big event was Friday when those numbers came out, and everybody was gathered around and see what the numbers look like. And we do that today, and we look at it every week. And actually, we are seeing broad money growing a little bit faster than it was before. And we're seeing narrow money, which is MZM, money of zero maturity, which is probably a better indicator given that we have such low interest rates and nobody wants to put money in the bank. So deposits are nobody wants to have money in term deposits when they don't pay any money. So it's sort of a miracle that we still have deposits in the banking system, term deposits. So if we look at MZM, that's been growing faster, and it's now at the top end over the past few years. And it's accelerating. And the reason it's accelerating is because we're starting to have banks, at least the second-tier banks and third-tier banks, increasing loans. Loans have increased in the past 6 months at a 50% annual rate. That's pretty fast. And it will start increasing faster because banks have the wherewithal to do that. And so we're going to see money increasing faster, and that's going to spill into higher prices. We're getting very, very close to that happening. Again, we can time it exactly, but we know that will happen.
Al, I have a thoughtful question from an investor here that circles the discussion back to the beginning. Some of this we've covered, but I think that it serves as a good summary to the talk that we've had this morning. I'm going to put it to you, I'm going to read it to you precisely as it was written. The investor writes, this is one question with three parts to it. As an investor who has sought to diversify via different styles and through managers with varying macro points of view, I wonder if you can explain to me what is it that you add to a diversified portfolio? Specifically, in what way do you differentiate from other macro players? It has been true that Friedberg has historically performed very well during cataclysmic periods. Does that mean that I should expect outperformance only in such times? You've lost money for almost 3 years, a time when most managers have shown gains, some more, some less. Does this mean that under more or less unchanged conditions, and by that he means weak global growth, low inflation, great monetary stimulus, you will continue to lose money?
Wow. That's a long question. And that's
it
a
is.
Hard question.
As he says, it's a three-part question.
Three-part question.
It's mindfully constructed.
Then it actually take a whole morning to answer. But let me answer as quickly and as best as I can. First, I think the first part of the question was, what is it that we bring to the table that's different than other managers, correct?
Yes.
And I think that what it is, of course, every manager wants to say that he's the best. I mean, that's not something to discuss. But I think that...
I think in this alpha-driven world, if a manager doesn't believe that,
right.
The investors in that manager are in trouble.
That's right. So, yes, we do this. But, I don't think there's that many managers today that look at monetary factors. Monetary factors have sort of disappeared from the discussion. They have even disappeared from the discussion of central banks. There are very few central banks. I give you an example. Canada and New Zealand, we read their reports, and we read the reports almost of many central banks, don't even mention money supply. So understanding money and monetary policy is something that we've been doing for a long time, and we think that that's something that most managers don't, and we think that that is an important, very important part in understanding the dynamics of deflation and inflation. So maybe that's one thing. And another thing that we are proud of, but we certainly do, is being contrarians. And I believe that more so than most other global managers, macro managers, we're very, very contrarian. We take very contrarian views, not because they are contrarian, but it just happens to be that my mind works that way. So so you will have exposure to a view or to a sector that you're not likely to have with other managers because of that, right? Because it's a contrarian view. And so, there are times that being contrarian is actually the wrong thing to be. That's when everybody in the street will say, well, the Federal Reserve is printing money, you just have to buy. You can't go short. Well, that's true. And we were contrarians. We said, no, you got to go short. So contrarian is not always the right thing to be, but at least it's a view that it's not represented by other managers, and therefore it's something that somebody who's diversifying and who has many investments should certainly have a portion of that money invested with people who are contrarian. Now, I mean, that's a short answer to the first part. The other parts are, one of the questions I remember was that we always make money in cataclysmic events, and it's true, we do, but just as many times we've made money in situations where not cataclysmic, were favorable, and we discussed that earlier in the conversation. And so, if things remain the way it is, and the way they are now, given the fact that we no longer are looking actively and in a big way to hedge the risk until we see the one thing that will change the central bank's mind, until we see inflation, given that, I believe that even with current muddling through type of environment, we should be able to make money. So that was the last one, and I think the middle of the one, I can't remember.
I think that covers the point. I think you've covered the point, and if this question was sent to us anonymously, if the question hasn't been covered adequately, please send an email to me directly to drosberg@niagaracapital.ca, and I'll put it to Albert and discuss it with him and get back to you one way or another.
I just want to end up one thing, David, if I may.
Sure.
We've mentioned this in the beginning of the conversation, and I think it's important that the client should know. We have today few positions. We are betting today on few themes. We have high conviction. We have very high conviction on these themes, but they're very concentrated. So we can expect sometimes the market to have sharp movements, although, by the way, we have seen that even the sharp movements have been much less sharp than they were last year. When we were making those mistakes, and that's because we have much better risk control today, and so our volatility is not much greater than the S&P's volatility, certainly not what it was last year, but it is concentrated, and that's the risk of, you said it very well, it's the risk. Today we have gone to a risk of concentration, okay? And drawdowns can last 2 weeks, it's possible, and they may go on for a few days, and they look very scary, but we remain extremely confident that we are sitting on some excellent position with, by the way, a lot of cash. We have a very significant cash reserve, and we are very comfortable, and we're willing to sit it through. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I have a couple of questions here that deserve response to. I was going to say that perhaps we could address them privately, but given what's happened in the last couple of weeks, let's carry on, even though it extends past our time, just for a few more minutes. One question is again circles back to the beginning, and it's also from an astute investor who in effect says that asked the question: are you capitulating at precisely the wrong time? In other words, by having liquidated the shorts, the coverage, the protection that you took against the possibility of a catastrophic event occurring, have you thrown in the towel in exactly the same way that I was throwing in the towel after riding cotton down from a record high to almost 40 cents? You just can't take it anymore, and reason is suspended by that kind of reptilian fear that you have when you keep losing money. How have you guarded yourself against that, or have you? Could you address that? I think it's a legitimate.
Yeah. Well, first is that we didn't capitulate in one day. I think that usually happens when you capitulate in one day, and then
it's a decision that's made. It's true, but nonetheless, I mean, it was a decision that may have taken longer to execute.
The decision took about 6 or 7 or 8 months. Because we've been reducing that kind of exposure for the last 6-7 months. So it's a decision that was done quietly, slowly, under some pressure, but not under panic conditions. Okay, so that reduces the risk of capitulating at the wrong time. Doesn't eliminate it, but reduces it. Secondly, that's possible, but the reason why we reduced it was not because of a belief necessarily, it was because the instruments that we used to hedge, every one of them, just about every one of them, with maybe the exception of the Bund, underperformed or performed against us. So at some point, you have to respect the market. You know, there's a certain amount to be said for stubbornness, but eventually you can be run over. And so you got to close those positions when they're going against you, and if the market is telling you that you're going against it. So it's not just a change in thinking and in sentiment, but it is also a market-driven kind of a decision in that sense. And finally, I think that we have given it a very good, let's call it intellectual patina. Is that the way it's called? Patina?
Patina.
Patina? A very good intellectual patina, meaning we're not convinced that they're willing to do anything. I mean, we see it now in China, as an example. China vowed that they would would not increase credit, that would drive money supply growth down, that they would try to do whatever they can in order to soften the rate of growth of credit. And now, in the last 2 days, they've changed their minds. They've now, once again now, under pressure, refinanced provinces. So what I'm saying is we see it now. It's a pattern that repeats itself. Central banks are caught. Governments are caught in the grip of easy solutions. And it's hard for me to see that they should be able to change unless they are forced to change. The only thing that will force them to change will be an outbreak of inflation. There's no other reason for them to do it.
Al, this final question relates to the other fund that we manage. This discussion has largely been regarding the Global Macro Hedge Fund, which is the flagship fund of Friedberg Mercantile Group, but you also manage, and Niagara also represents, the Asset Allocation Fund, which operates according to the same set of analytical principles, but executes those ideas in an entirely different way, is unleveraged and long only. Can you explain the difference in the returns other than just simply by the systemic or the systematic differences in the structure?
Well, I think that's the answer. The answer is we did not pursue a hedging activity or a protective activity in any way, in any aggressive way. The most that we did was vary the proportion of bonds in the portfolio and say, if we are very nervous, if we think that the environment is fraught with danger, we're going to have a higher proportion of fixed income. And we did. We actually, for the last 6 months, I think we've had 58% of the portfolio is in bonds of the highest quality. We had booms and we had tips. This is really what, we had a discussion of this, or at least I wrote about this, and I still have it in my head thinking, maybe that's a better way of doing things, because maybe in the long run, it is very difficult to catch significant market moves that are, let's say, negative market moves, because historically, asset prices have increased. And so only every 4 or 5 or 6 or 3 years or 8 years, you have significant down moves. And so to catch them is very difficult, and to bet on them statistically is difficult. And so maybe the best thing to do is just to sidestep the whole issue and say, you know what, if you're nervous, just hold a larger proportion of money in fixed income, in the high-quality fixed income, if you're nervous. And if you're not nervous, then make it less. I believe that that's where the difference is. But the macro scenarios, the same macro scenario, and we've used it, and you can see the difference there clearly.
We've spoken an hour today, 15 minutes longer than we normally do. I thank you for your time. I thank investors for listening. And on behalf of all of them, I wish you good luck and certainly better luck than you suffered the last 2 weeks in April.
Thank you, David. Thank you.
Okay. Goodbye to all. And once again, we recall that the contents of this call will be posted on the Niagara and on the Friedberg websites. Thank you.